It is Wednesday, November 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, New York police say the suspect in Tuesday's attack in Manhattan acted in the name of ISIS. The Federal Reserve may be getting a new chairman, and a new documentary shows the roots of the deep political divisions in the United States. It's all ahead. Authorities in New York are questioning the driver of a rented pickup truck who mowed down people on a busy bike path Tuesday, attempting to learn his motive for the deadly terror incident. At least 8 people were killed and 11 others injured in the attack. Officials link the suspect, 29-year-old Saifullo Saipov, an Uzbek immigrant who came to the United States in 2010, to social media accounts that contain Islamic State-related material. News reports say that a note was found at the scene of the attack in which he claimed allegiance to the jihadist group. Saipov was shot in the abdomen by a New York policeman in the lower Manhattan area of the city, but survived. Authorities questioned him before he underwent surgery Tuesday evening. On Wednesday, New York Deputy Police Commissioner John Miller described the initial findings.
Based on the investigation overnight, it appears that Mr. Saipov had been planning this for a number of weeks. He did this in the name of ISIS, and along with the other items recovered at the scene was some notes that further indicate that.
President Donald Trump says he will work with Congress immediately to end the diversity lottery program, which allowed Saipov to immigrate to the U.S.
I am today starting the process of terminating the diversity lottery program. I'm going to ask Congress to immediately initiate work to get rid of this program, diversity and diversity lottery. Diversity lottery sounds nice. It's not nice. It's not good. It's not good. It hasn't been good. We've been against it.
Navbahar Imamova is a broadcaster for VOA's Uzbek service. She tells me what's known about the suspect.
We know that Saifullo Saipov came to the United States in 2010 as a legal resident. We believe that he won the green card lottery. And this is the way thousands of Uzbeks have come to the United States for the past 2 decades. So basically, green card gives you the right to live and work here permanently. When he came, he did not speak much English. We know that he struggled to assimilate. We know that he went to Ohio to live with some of his remote, distant relatives. And after living there for a while, he moved to Florida. That's where he tried to establish himself. His driver's license is from Tampa, Florida. So we know that he lived the longest there. And then in 2013, he got married to another Uzbek immigrant. We don't know much about his family situation. Many people tell us that they knew of him, but they didn't necessarily know him. Mm-hmm. He was a very secluded guy. He wasn't a social guy. He wasn't active on social media. He wasn't a very talkative person. He pretty much kept to himself. People describe him as a hardworking person. He worked all the time. And by that, they mean that he was driving trucks, basically. He worked for several various companies who used his services. He moved to New Jersey sometime this year. He worked for Uber for about 6 months, and there too he didn't have any major issues. So now the Uzbek community obviously is in a state of shock. They're shocked and saddened at the same time. They tell us that they never expect any of them to be committing such horrible things. But then we also know that for the past 2 years, at least 7 people who are identified as ethnic Uzbeks, most of them are from Uzbekistan and some of them are from the other parts of Central Asia, have been arrested on the suspicion of supporting or trying to support terrorism. So the notion of Uzbek terrorist suspects, or I would also say that the notion of Uzbek terrorists, have been around for a long time. So Central Asia has struggled with extremism, radicalism, and terrorism for a long time.
And the investigation is continuing and probably will look into which, say, if he attended mosques, and also looking at his computer, any communications he might have had.
Right? Yes, and yesterday, too, the witnesses and then tell us that he shouted Allahu Akbar. But to be able to say that, you don't have to be fluent in Arabic. Yeah. This is a word that many Muslims pronounce every day, and so we can't assume a lot of things, I'm afraid. This is the first time in history an Uzbek committed a terror attack on the American soil.
VOA's Nabahor Imamova. Karen Greenberg is the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law in New York City. She describes the significance of the attack.
This is the first lethal terrorist attack with a vehicle in the United States. There was an attempt last year with a vehicle at a college campus in the United States, but it didn't result in any deaths. So this is the first lethal attack of this kind. So it is a threshold moment for us.
Is it known about the timing, the fact that this was coming up to an official holiday, you know, Halloween, and there was going to be a nearby Halloween parade?
It could have been that. You never know. It was closer to the World Trade Center than it was the original World Trade Center than it was to the Halloween parade. So you never know. It's hard to imagine that they were completely separable, the parade and this. I thought it was rather amazing that the public officials in New York, the mayor of New York, the governor of New York, the police commissioner, all agreed that they should continue with this parade no matter what, which was, I thought, a rather brave message, and it sent a very good signal to New Yorkers that they're safe. So it may have been timed that way, and it turned out to have worked in a way that I think strengthened the reassurances rather than minimized them.
Is it known any possible connection between the suspect and ISIS?
There were notes found. There are different reports. Some say there was a note found in the truck, the rented truck that was used to mow down these bicyclists. Others say there were notes found outside the truck, and that these notes or note said that this attack was being done in the name of ISIS. What that means, usually in this country, it means some form of self-radicalization where an individual decides to identify his violent attack with saying that he's aligned with ISIS, but it's usually a very loose association. So that's all that's known at this point.
Since ISIS has lost militarily some of its geographical points in the Middle East recently, I know that there have been concerns from a number of observers that perhaps there might be more attacks in whether either North America or in Europe. Does this mean that the United States and Canada and Europe need to be especially vigilant in the coming days and months?
I think that the vigilance has kind of been at the same level in terms of ISIS since the first ISIS indictment in this country, which was March of 2014. There are varying interpretations of what the disappearance of the caliphate and of ISIS actually having territory will mean. And one is, yes, that it'll have more localized attacks. But, you know, Americans, the Americans and the people living in the United States who wanted to go and fight ISIS has been a dwindling percentage of the ISIS cases for the last couple of years. It has been individuals who have focused more of their attention here recently. So that's the first thing. The second thing is one of the big concerns about having a caliphate and individuals going there is that they get trained. And so as much as it might spread a message of violence and hatred that may, you know, get people to affiliate with it and commit violence, one of the real concerns of law enforcement and national security officials, and this is true globally, is to keep these individuals from getting trained. Now, it's true, it doesn't take much to go rent a truck and get some what looked like they were fake guns. But the fact is that if you can decrease the amount of organized, trained violence, you're helping counterterrorism efforts immensely. And so I'm not sure how the loss of the caliphate will play out. I think over the long haul, it will weaken ISIS and its message significantly.
Karen Greenberg, the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law in New York. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, I'm sure there's a lot of reaction on social media to all of this.
There is, and there are a lot of people talking about why this attack occurred, the motivation behind it, the gentleman who committed this attack. But a lot of people talking about President Trump tweeting about this diversity visa lottery program, saying that he wants visas to be merit-based and not given through a lottery. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said that those tweets were not helpful and that Trump was pointing fingers and politicizing the situation. And people are indeed politicizing this attack on social media. There are calls to limit immigration, calls to renew President Trump's immigration ban. Those are countered with fears about discrimination against Muslims and calls to resist hate, saying it's very easy to target the entire religion in this case. So you have this back and forth that has been going on really, unfortunately, every time we have one of these attacks. You see this back and forth, this politicization of this these attacks that happen. But at the same time, you see New York continuing to go on. The Greenwich Village Halloween Parade in its fifth decade continued on last night. In fact, the governor of New York and the mayor of New York City marched in that parade. And officials say that the New York City Marathon will continue on this Sunday as planned. Many people saying on social media that these two instances exemplify New York and that the city is undeterred by terror. And you see a lot of New Yorkers saying, we're going to proceed on with our lives even after this terrorist attack. We're not going to let the terrorists win. And as we were talking about before we went on air, there's so much news going on, a lot of it talking about this New York City terror attack. But another big story here in Washington, representatives from Facebook, Twitter, and Google are on Capitol Hill testifying in front of lawmakers about Russian interference on social media during the presidential election here in the U.S. Big news that they've said the numbers are higher than they initially reported and that the scope is broader. We'll wait and see what comes out of that. But very tense moments on Capitol Hill as well as they try to get to the bottom of that interference.
All right. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories we are following. Reuters says the United States is engaging in secret diplomatic overtures to North Korea. Myanmar blames Bangladesh for delaying the return of ethnic Muslim refugees. An airstrike kills 26 people in Yemen, and U.S. social media companies are grilled on the Russian disinformation. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
When volcanoes erupt, they blast huge amounts of gas and dust particles into the atmosphere. Scientists say the dust and gas reflect sunlight away from the Earth, causing a cooling effect. A new study by researchers at Columbia University suggests volcanic eruptions can also worsen the melting of our planet's ice sheets. Researchers say they found evidence volcanic eruptions quickly caused severe melting of the ice sheet that blanketed a good part of northern Europe toward the end of the last ice age between 12 and 13,000 years ago. The study notes that in some cases, the erupting volcanoes were located 1,000 or more miles away. The surface of the ice sheet was darkened by the falling volcanic ash, which allowed it to absorb more solar heat than usual. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new documentary explores America's polarized politics. Reports citing senior Trump administration officials have said President Trump is likely to name Jerome J. Powell, a current member of the Federal Reserve Board, to replace Janet Yellen as chairman, with an announcement planned Thursday. However, these officials caution the decision is not yet final and Ms. Yellen may be handed another term, or it may go to a third possibility, Stanford University economist John Taylor. The choice will be crucial to the U.S. and global economies. Gary Huffbauer, an economist with the Washington-based Peterson Institute, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, while Yellen has generally pursued monetary policies Mr. Trump has advocated, the decision may come down to the president's decision to nominate his own person to head the U.S. central bank.
That's probably the dominant reason. There's a second reason, though, and that's that Trump feels that the Fed has been overly strict in regulating banks. And Yellen is part of that overly strict group, you could say, in the Fed, which Trump is trying to replace. And there, on that issue, one of the candidates, namely Jerome Powell, is a little less aggressive on regulating the banks, more willing to relax some of the regulation. So that's the reason why his name, that is Jerome Powell, seems to be the number one, because he very much the same monetary policy that Yellen has been advocating, but more relaxed on the bank regulation. So that, I think, appeals to President Trump, that combination.
But between the two, they're basically the policy of on gradual interest rate hikes will probably continue.
Yes, it would. And there, the third candidate that you mentioned, Professor John Taylor, whom I know, is thought to be a little more hawkish. I don't think a lot more hawkish, but he is more hawkish than either Yellen or Powell. And what does that really mean? Well, here's the issue. Interest rates have been below the rate of inflation. We don't have much inflation, but interest rates are still lower. When inflation gets up to 2%, will the Fed at that point raise interest rates to be a little bit above inflation? That probably is where Taylor would be. But Yellen or Powell probably would have a pause on that and say, well, we need to have a bit of catch up on the inflation. So it's okay if it goes to 2.5%. We don't need to push the interest rates up to 3%. So that's the real difference between Yellen and Powell on the one hand and Taylor on the other.
Gary Huffbauer of the Peterson Institute. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. What did Americans think about the presidential elections on Election Day last year? In the documentary 11-8-16, executive producer Jeff Deutschman showcases 16 Americans from all walks of life throughout that day. The result is an eye-opening documentary about the political and cultural divides that still polarize Americans today. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with Deutschman about his work.
Did you vote today?
From the liberal college student to the conservative West Virginia coal miner,
the election, the future for the coal industry.
Jeff Deutschman's documentary, 11-8-16, follows American voters during Election Day last November. He showcases 16 out of the 50 voters his team of filmmakers had followed that day across the United States.
We wanted it to be a broad cross-section of individuals that represented, you know, diversity geographically, demographically, and ideologically.
From a Sikh cabbie supporting Democrat Hillary Clinton in Queens, New York, to an exonerated convict in Alabama who gets back his right to vote for the first time in 30 years, to a pro-Donald Trump military veteran in Miami, and a dreamer whose future is at stake if Trump won, 11-8-16 shows that people voted on issues they felt affected them personally. The film also shows that most believed media projections that Hillary Clinton was going to win.
The election will be over by 9 o'clock. They'll call it by 9:30, and everything will be peaceful and wonderful.
What if it goes the other way?
What? It's not going to go the other way. No way. Mark it down.
Jeff Deutschman says his documentary reveals deep cultural divisions in American society the media missed.
So I think it's important not to get stuck in the echo chambers that we all live in. You know, we surround ourselves with people virtually and in real life that are like-minded, and I understand that. I do it as much as anyone. But I think it's really important to try and regularly confront the fact that of how big this country is, and to allow that vastness to inform the decisions that we make about how we vote and, you know, how we speak.
The film does not take sides. We get invested in these 16 characters who, despite their political leanings, make compelling arguments based on their circumstances, as in the case of Tom, a small businessman from Massachusetts.
If the economy got better and I was bringing more people and more work into my shop and I could delegate a little bit more, then I'd be able to spend more time with my family. That'd be huge. That would be huge for me.
The film also shows how campaign messages and partisan media feed into people's prejudices and fears.
When Hillary gets elected, and I think she's going to get elected because she's going to
cheat.
She's going to raise the taxes on everybody, and healthcare right now is crushing us anyway. So I'm concerned that we're going to have a tough time making ends meet.
Take that stupid hat off, man.
I will not take this hat off.
On the other side of the spectrum, the documentary also shows the concerns of minorities if Donald Trump won. Deutschman says a year later, America remains deeply polarized across the same lines. He hopes that films like his, by humanizing the American electorate, can encourage dialogue. Penelope Pulu, VOA News.
Thanks very much, Penelope. That is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. and its international allies and partners are taking new steps to ensure that President Donald Trump's vision for a world that is secure against terrorist threats is realized, said U.S. Coordinator for Counterterrorism Nathan Sales in a recent interview. One of those steps is the recent endorsement with partners of the Global Counterterrorism Forum of the Anatolia Memorandum on the Protection of Soft Targets.
The Anatolia memo contains a number of practices for governments and private sector entities to use together in cooperation to protect places to which the public is invited. Stadiums, restaurants, parks, sidewalks, against terrorist threats. This is an increasing trend that we're seeing overseas. We're seeing it here at home. And so it's important for us all to work together to secure our public spaces against terrorist attacks.
The United States, in partnership with Morocco, also recently announced the launch of a new initiative to address the growing threat posed by homegrown terrorists. We've seen in the past 3 years a number of foreign terrorist fighters who have traveled to Iraq and Syria to fight with ISIS, some of whom have come home and perpetrated deadly terrorist attacks, said Ambassador Sales. But that's not the only threat we face.
We also have to be mindful of people who are inspired by ISIS or inspired by Al-Qaeda. They may not have a membership card, they may not have any battlefield experience, but it doesn't take much more than simply renting a truck and driving it into a crowd. So the threat of homegrown terrorism, people without any operational ties, is a very serious problem. It's a threat that's on the rise, and it's one that we're going to be focusing on.
The United States and Global Counterterrorism Forum partners are also focusing on strengthening criminal justice and other rule of law institutions that confront terrorism.
Counterterrorism is not just for soldiers. It's not just for spies. It's also for cops. And so part of what we've done here in the United States is create capabilities for state law enforcement officers and federal law enforcement officers alike to partner together to bring cases, to bring criminal charges in cases where that's warranted.
We're doing the same sort of thing, said Ambassador Sales, standing up these capabilities with partners around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.